You're listening to an Ancient Future podcast from St. Benedict's Table, a congregation of the Anglican Church of Canada, located in Winnipeg, Manitoba. I'm your host, Jamie Howison. For this one, we're going deep into our archives. A recording from 2009. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove spent some time with our community. I first met Jonathan in 2008 at a writing retreat at the Collegeville Institute designed for pastoral leaders who understood writing as a key part of their vocation. At first, I wasn't quite sure what to make of this guy, a long, lanky young man dressed in work pants and a t-shirt, with a North Carolina accent that reflected perfectly his laid-back demeanor. At the time, he wasn't yet 30 years old, yet he'd been in Iraq with Christian peacemaker teams, was immersed in a predominantly African-American church context, living with his wife and child at Rutba House, a new monastic community in Durham, and had written perceptive and penetrating books based on each of these foundational experiences. Jonathan, though, didn't seem to find any of that to be a very big deal. The only thing that did seem to be of any consequence to him was actually figuring out how to live what we believe. That was a big deal, but only insofar as it helped us to be what we were meant to be. Well, it quickly became clear to me that it would be a good thing to bring Jonathan to Winnipeg, to spend a few days with the St. Benedict's Table community. As a church, we're this sort of odd hybrid of Anglican liturgy and spirituality, some Anabaptist sensibilities, a good dose of evangelical immediacy, and a far-ranging student, artist, musician-driven poetic spirit of questioning. We pay attention to Benedictine hospitality and spiritual disciplines, but keep seeking to root those in an utterly new social and cultural context. Who better to have as a guest in our community than a Baptist from the South, living in a new monastic community and taking some of his most important lessons from both the Mennonites and the Benedictines? What you're about to listen to is a presentation Jonathan offered at an idea exchange evening hosted at Aqua Books on November 14th, 2009, based on his then recently published book, God's Economy. He talked to us about how to think about money.
Well, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here in Winnipeg and delighted that it's so warm. At least they say this is warm. I'd like to talk about God's economy in the economic crisis. I've just published this book on God's economy, and I thought I'd try to summarize it for you in 30 minutes, and then maybe we can talk about it. It seems to me these days there's lots of opportunity to talk about alternative economics, especially since the economy that we have is falling apart. You know, Leonard Cohen says there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. And I figure, hey, this is a good time to pitch God's economy to people. Because after all, most of what Jesus says about money, we just ignore, right? I mean, Jesus doesn't exactly look like a financial advisor or someone who could have become a CEO. And most people figure that what he said, it probably wouldn't work. So we tend to write it off. But I learned an important distinction from a Ugandan priest that has really helped me reread Jesus, especially what Jesus has to say about money. My friend Emmanuel Katongole from Uganda taught me the distinction between strategy and tactics. So I thought I'd lay this out for you all tonight because it'll help me reread a few things that Jesus said. Emmanuel says strategy is what all of us know. We people who've been through the education system of the West, we people who've had access to power and who've been in charge of things, we know how to do strategy. Strategy is the way you plan. When you can get around a board table and have everybody sit down and you have all the resources at your disposal and you figure out the best way to arrange things so that you can meet the needs that are there with the resources that are available. That's strategy. And, you know, it's a pretty good way to run things, you know, if you're on the board or if you're the president of the country or something like that. It's helpful to have a strategy. Otherwise, people will call you irresponsible. On the other hand, tactics are the weapons of the weak. Tactics are what you have to do when you're not in charge in order to figure out how to slip something else in. Tactics are what you slip in through the cracks to try to subvert what's there. And the fascinating thing to me is that Jesus seems to have had something of a tactical imagination. At least it helps me to read Jesus this way, because especially on money, I wasn't sure what sense to make of Jesus in the kind of world of strategy that I came from. I think part of the problem is that my own strategic thinking and my training in that way of thinking, it hadn't taught me to make sense of what it means for something to be a power, for money to be a power. After all, Jesus does seem to think that money has a force that's greater in our lives than just something that we can use, right? More than like the dollar bills in your pocket that you can spend for what you need. Money seems to have a power to be something that would even demand your allegiance. This is what Jesus says, right? You cannot serve God and money. Money being sort of the other God competing for our allegiance in this world. I've struggled to make sense of this, but one thing that has really helped me see it is my son Jamichael, who loves candy. Candy is a force in his life. I mean, like a power. It demands all sorts of religious ritual and obligation. You know, candy has a special place in our house. He has to do all sorts of, you know, rituals to get his candy. And so this has kind of gotten me thinking about, well, what does it mean to have something to have that much power over us? You know, some of the things he does help me make sense of some of the odd ads, you see, ads that seem to promise a lot more than what most products like shampoo offer. Jamichael brought me this book that I'd read before called Pinocchio. Y'all know this story? He brought this book to me, Pinocchio, and I was struck by this, especially in light of this reflection on power. I was reading this story of, you know, the puppet made of wood by Geppetto, and he's trying to become real, so he has to go off to school by himself, and on his way to school, he's tripped up by this fella, J. Worthington Foulfellow, and knowing nothing of dramatic irony, Pinocchio goes along with this Foulfellow, and he takes him to this pleasure island, right, where there's candy everywhere, and we get to this page, and my son says, "Candy." You know, it's got his attention all of a sudden. And it turns out what Foulfellow does on this island, he lets kids do whatever they want and enjoy the candy and throw mud and break things until they start turning into donkeys. And then he sells them to the salt mine. And the salt mines make them their slaves for the rest of their lives. I thought, wow, there's a power. And there's a story that tells us the truth about what that power will do to you, right? Here's something that promises such great stuff, but it really turns you into an ass and makes you work the rest of your life in order to pay it all off. And I got to thinking about how, you know, a lot of people feel that way in their middle age. But what can you do? Because after all, you've got debt and you've got a mortgage and all this other stuff to do. And so it seemed to me that Jesus might be onto something, that this money has a kind of power over us that demands our allegiance. And so this idea of tactics got me thinking, and I got to thinking about, well, what if all these things that we usually ignore that Jesus said are really just tactical teachings? And so I went to the scriptures, the gospels, with that in mind, and tried to read at least five of the things that Jesus said about money as tactics for a good life. Now I have to say, this isn't as much the context here, I gather, by looking at the crowd and by the fact that I'm in Canada, but in the United States and in the neighborhood where I live, we have this thing called the prosperity gospel. You may have heard about this in the news, maybe even have a few here. But the idea is often proclaimed that Jesus has a great life to offer you, and it looks a lot like the American dream. The way we know that it's true is that the pastors seem to embody a sort of wealth. So it's really important that the pastors have bright, shining teeth and clothes much nicer than mine and drive fancy cars. They sort of become an icon of a certain form of success that really attracts a lot of people. Even people in my neighborhood, you know, people who don't have much, but they would rather stay home and watch Joel Osteen and hear his promises than come to the local church. I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, well, you know, why is this so powerful? And it occurred to me that these people are partly right, these prosperity preachers. They're partly right because what they say is really a response to what I take to be one of the greatest sins of North American Christianity, which is that we have over-spiritualized the gospel to be something that has to do with our afterlife or our inner life, but not with how we actually live. I actually think this is deeply rooted in my own context in the U.S. It's deeply rooted in America's original sin of slavery. I sort of stumbled on this as someone who was raised Southern Baptist. At 16, I made friends with a black pastor who informed me that I was a racist because I came from Klan country and I didn't even know it. As he was sort of teaching me this, I learned a lot about the history of my own church and how, indeed, the Southern Baptist Church was started because Southern people wanted to keep their slaves. If you start a church on the basis of that, you really got to do some theological thinking, you know, to figure out how this works. There's a very clear theology that was worked out of trying to explain how it was a good thing, even a Christian thing, to keep slaves. And what they said was that it was better for those Africans who had been heathens to be here as slaves and know the gospel than to have been there and free where they would die and go to hell. That was the theology, right? So there's a sharp distinction between the state of your spirit and the present state of your body. Once we had thought that up to justify one terrible sin, it sort of infected much of our Christianity. And for so many people, for so much of our country's history, Christianity has been suspect because it doesn't really promise anything different than the status quo in the here and now. And I think a lot of people, a lot of my neighbors, and a whole lot of people in the global South are about done with that. And that's why they're so eager to hear this prosperity gospel, because it says, wait a second, Jesus does offer you something here and now. Jesus offers you your best life now. That's what Joel Osteen says. And I think he's partly right. Jesus does offer something in the here and now. I think it's just very different, a very different way of life than the American dream. Indeed, I think we sell ourselves short if we don't listen closely to what Jesus said as a tactical thinker. So I went back and paid attention to these tactics from Jesus. And there are five of them that I lay out in the book, but I only have 30 minutes, so I'll tell you one. So one of the things Jesus does in the 16th chapter of Luke's gospel. If we were at a church, I would say you can get your Bibles out, but no, sorry, I'll tell you the story. In the 16th chapter of Luke's gospel, there's a story that often doesn't get told in church because we're not sure what to make of it. But it's a story that comes right out of the economy of the ancient world. It's about a business. And in the ancient world, they didn't have corporations yet. They hadn't come up with this concept. It was just households. You know, households ran businesses. But like most of our businesses in this world, the people who own the thing, the head of the household, the paterfamilias in the ancient world, didn't really want to do the work. You know, he needed to be freed up to go, in Jesus' context, to go down to Jerusalem and meet with the politicians and, you know, to hang out with his friends and the other things that people do when they have money. He hires a manager to run things. This manager, of course, is a person who's kind of risen up from the lower classes and who, you know, has a bit of skill and has gotten enough education to get himself into this position. But his job is to really run things. So in this sort of in between the big man and the common people, the manager would sort of work it like people do in that kind of position. You know, he worked his influence. He would take what he could, you know, under the table here and there to kind of get a little extra in the world. And this was okay, really. It was mostly accepted. But because it could get out of hand sometimes, CEOs or the head guys in charge would sometimes ask for an accounting. And Jesus tells this story in which the big guy in charge is either nervous because of rumors he's heard or he's worried about there not being enough coming in. And so he asks his manager for an accounting. And the manager realizes he's in trouble. I'm not sure what he's done. It doesn't say in the story, but he has to think quick. And so he goes to people who have accounts with his master, and he says, hey, you know, this is a wholesale company, big amounts. He says, you got 800 bushels of wheat on the accounts. Could you pay it if I cut it in half? And the guy says, hey, that's a good deal. And so he pays it off, and he's happy. And then he goes over here to this other fella and says, hey, you got 1,000 gallons of oil on your account. I'll cut it to 800 if you can pay it today. And the guy says, great, sure. And so he goes around, you know, it's half off sale at the wholesale shop this day, and everybody's happy. And he makes the rounds before master gets back in town. And you can imagine now Now, Jesus doesn't spell this out for us, but you can imagine sort of seeing the scene. Master coming into town and running into all these people who know that he's had half off sale this week. And they're all very happy. You know, hey, thanks to the big man. Good to see you. Glad you did that. And of course, all along the way, Master's thinking, what's going on here? And slowly, you know, it occurs to him that his manager has pulled this over on him. And Jesus says, when he speaks to the manager, he commended him. He commended him because he was shrewd with worldly wealth. And Jesus says, the people of this world are wiser with wealth than you are. And Jesus gave this tactic. He said, you ought to use money to make friends. Use money to make friends. You ever heard that at church? Jesus said it. It's right there in Luke 16. Use money to make friends. Which, you know, in a sort of strategic way of thinking, sounds sort of like, you know, good old boyism. You know, use money to make friends. But Jesus is talking about the perspective of peasants in Palestine. I think Jesus is showing us not how to overthrow this world's economy, sort of take it over and do something new. Jesus is showing us how to live when you can't drive the Romans out, but rather how to interject something new and more powerful into this world system. I sometimes say that, you know, in terms of the models we have in the world today, I think it's important to realize that Jesus and his teaching and his movement looks more like Al-Qaeda than it does like McDonald's. I mean, this is important. In the States, that'll make some people mad because we're all after Al-Qaeda right now. But, you know, the truth is, we just assume that Jesus works like McDonald's. Jesus started this movement. He had 12 guys. You know, they got it started. They started these churches. And it's basically a franchise business, you know, that spread all around the world. Billions and billions served. But not what Jesus does is actually teach tactics to people who don't have an antagonistic vision of the world that is, that can only say, blow it up. But rather, people who say, we know that another world is possible because the one who made it has told us, and we believe that if we just slip a little bit of it in here and there in the cracks, it'll take over. In the South, we have a great analogy for this. It's called kudzu. I don't know if y'all know what kudzu is, but we got this weed that if you plant it just a little bit anywhere, it'll take over. It covers whole forests in the South. You can drive down highways in Mississippi and just see trees and trees that are covered in this kudzu. And I think that's, Jesus didn't actually say it that way, but I think that the kingdom of God is like a kudzu plant. You know, if you just slip a little bit in here and there, it will take over. So use money to make friends. I think it's a tactic for economic friendship, for using what we have to share and to make friends. One way that I've had a chance to participate in this is actually a story that comes out of a pretty conservative church in Florida that 25 years ago it had a pastor, and the pastor and his family were in a car accident. And the pastor was hurt pretty significantly, went to the hospital. When he was there, he racked up this pretty big bill. And all the time he was in there, he was worried about how he was going to pay for it because he didn't have any insurance. When he was discharged, he went to the hospital's administrator, and he said, I don't know exactly how I'm going to cover this, but go ahead and tell me what I owe you, and I'll try to make a plan. And the guy said, you don't owe me anything. And he said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, somebody came in here and paid it yesterday. He went back to his church and told the story, and they said, yeah, Pastor, you know, we really love you, and we wanted to support you, and we pooled together some of our money, and we paid your bill. And he said, thank you. But then he got to thinking, like pastors sometimes do, and his thinking turned into a sermon. And he came back the next Sunday, and he said to them, you know, if you did this for me, we ought to be able to do this for each other. Because after all, Paul's letter to the Galatians said, bear ye one another's burdens. So that's what we ought to do. And so they started this little healthcare co-op. 20 years later, when my family joined it, there were about 30,000 people who were part of it. We all put in money every month to be part of this thing, because after all, that's what we want to use our money for, right? Use money to make friends. And then when one of our friends is in need, we're able to share and to take care of those needs. It's not insurance. It's just a pool of money that we use to share needs with people who we're bound to because we've been made part of the body of Christ. I'm part of this Christian community in Durham, and it's kind of been our laboratory for this sort of thing. We're a house of hospitality, and
We invite people who don't have homes to live with us. We can't invite everybody who doesn't have a home to live with us, but people we know, we invite them to live with us because we think life is better together than it is apart. And it ain't always easy, but we've learned a lot from living together. And in that context, about 5 years ago, we invited a young man from our neighborhood who had become homeless to come and live with us. He was 15 at the time, trying to finish high school. 10 years before, his father had killed his mother, and he had kind of bounced between foster homes and extended family who ultimately weren't able to take care of him. And so he landed with us at 15. He finished high school, and he went off to college, and is actually in his senior year this year, getting ready to graduate. But last year, he called me one day, and he said, I got this terrible pain in my tooth. It's just been killing me for days. What should I do about it? And I said, well, you got to see a dentist. I looked one up and said, go see these folks and tell them to call me when they figure out what it is. So they called from this dentist office in Greensboro, down the road from where we live. And they said, well, he needs 2 root canals. That'll be $4,000. And I said, wow, that's a lot of money. But I immediately thought of this other group that we're part of. A number of years ago, some people in our kind of extended community of communities decided when we were studying the Old Testament and the idea of the tithe in the Old Testament, that this notion in the people of God in Israel of having 10% of what we get from our work and from the land, having it pooled together to take care of the Levites who served the temple, but also of the poor and the widows, was an important idea. And we said we wanted to kind of be part of that together. And so we started this relational tithe, and we said we'd put money in it every month, and we would use it only to give to people we were in a relationship with, no more than one degree of separation, because after all, we use money to make friends, right? We want to be in a relationship with the people that we're able to share with. So we have this thing. And when I heard that we needed $4,000, I immediately thought of this group. It's a great online system. I don't exactly understand how it works, but I know if I go to my email and I write to this group, they can get the request, and if people approve it, then a check gets cut and sent to me. And I did it, and the check came before the credit card bill, and it was great. But then Alvin went back for his follow-up appointment, and the dentist said, called me and said, well, what he needs is 2 caps on those teeth where we did the root canals. And he needs something called periodontal work on one of the teeth because it won't quite fit. I didn't even know what that was, but they explained it to me. And they said it's going to be $5,000. And I said, wow, you know, no wonder you can't get dental insurance. This stuff's expensive. And so I hung up, and I started thinking, you know, what are we going to do? I didn't want to go right back to the relational tithe. So I thought we would work on our local friends. And we started calling around and talking to people who are friends of our community and who know this fella, and asking if people could pitch in. In just a day or two, we had $1,600. People were, these aren't people that have a lot of money. You know, these people who were really willing to sacrifice. And I thought, wow, that's really impressive. But that's still a long ways from $5,000. So I called back over there to the dentist's office, and I told the woman who answered, I said, you know, I haven't really told you much about this situation, but let me tell you this story. And I told her what I've just told you. I said, you know, it's really been incredible to be part of this kind of alternative economy of sharing, where, you know, all these people who are, you know, part of this together, it's this kind of sense of community and generosity. And it's just been great to be part of it. And I said, hey, wouldn't you want to be part of it too? And sweet, sweet Southern woman said to me, well, my heart says yes, but I'll have to ask the man in charge. And so she hung up the phone and called back a little bit later and said, we'd be glad to do this work for the $1,600 that you have. And I thought to myself, wow, this community that God invites us into by practicing these sort of odd ideas about money, you know, it includes all sorts of friends that we knew we had. And sometimes it's so compelling that it draws in people that we didn't expect, you know, maybe even the people that we thought were our enemies. And it seems to me that that's the core of what Jesus is teaching about money, is that it's an invitation into community with people who we maybe didn't think we needed, or people who we maybe didn't think would like us. But it's a place where the poor find bread and the rich find meaning, because we find each other, and we find it in community, and we're not alone anymore. And ultimately, I am a preacher after all. Ultimately, I think that is the good news of the gospel, that in such a community, we find ourselves reconciled to God. So that's why I'm a fan of God's economy, promoting it in the midst of this economic crisis. I hope you'll join me too.
We have some time for questions or comments or anything for clarification or...
I haven't read your book, but I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on the parable of the mustard seed.
Uh-huh.
For example, Jesus told them to plant the mustard seed in the garden, which is where they often planted their own food for their farm.
Mm-hmm.
And the mustard seed was a weed.
Yeah.
And it attracted birds, which were hostile to a garden. And it seemed that Jesus was forcing them to think a little radically about their life, like extremely different. So I don't know if you can comment on that.
Who wants birds in their garden, right?
It's a compelling parable. Jesus doesn't tell the parable about the kudzu, but he does tell the one about the mustard seed. The idea, of course, being that these little things, something so small as a mustard seed, can grow up into a tree into a weed that might even take over your garden. But maybe that's what we need. That parable is a reminder to me of how Jesus is willing to believe. And I think this is maybe the most radical part of Jesus' teaching. Jesus is willing to believe that poor people doing small things is the hope of the world. Not big people who run corporations getting together for a world summit to talk about how to end poverty. Not even a political campaign that tries to take over, whatever government and run it right. Nothing to be said about trying to run things better, but Jesus says the hope of the world is in poor people doing small things, like planting mustard seeds. And I think that sounds crazy to most of us, but I think that's what the church is all about, which is why it's perhaps the most radically democratic institution you could ever be part of. After all, just the normal old people that get kicked to the curb in society are actually God's friends. And that God's using us together to create something that's more powerful than anything. The letter to the Ephesians says that through this thing called the gathering of these people, through that gathering, the church, God's wisdom is being made known to the powers of this present world. That's a pretty incredible claim. And it reminds me of this great story from the Middle Ages where someone came to a church building and said, it was sort of a hold-up operation, and they said, we want you to give us all the riches of the church. And this priest brought out all the beggars and all the poor and said, these are our riches. It's the scene that Matthew paints in the fourth chapter of his gospel, where all these people are coming to Jesus because they're sick and they're lame and their lives are screwed up, is basically the picture he paints. And he spends a lot of time saying who's there. And then he begins the fifth chapter after setting the scene by saying that Jesus stood up and he taught them, saying, blessed are the poor, for the kingdom of heaven is yours. Every religious teacher in their world told them they were cursed. If you were lame, if you were sick, if you were beat up, if you were crazy, you were cursed. They come to Jesus somewhere else and say, did that person sin or did his parents sin for him to be like that? Somebody messed up and you were cursed. And Jesus looked at those people and says, no, you're blessed. You're blessed because you know that you need God, and that's the most important thing for getting in on this strange economy, this new kingdom that Jesus came teaching. So, yeah, I think that's all there in the mustard seed, this idea that the little things are really where the hope of the world lies.
Thanks for speaking to us tonight.
Oh, it's good to be here.
You mentioned what's commonly referred to as the prosperity gospel. I'm wondering if you've ever discussed the concept of God's economy with somebody who believes strongly in prosperity gospel, and if so, what their reaction was, and if not, what do you think their reaction would be?
Well, I haven't had a chance to talk to Joel Osteen yet. He hasn't called, but I was at a conference a few weeks ago in Ohio. I was giving a talk on this same book. I actually had time to go through all five tactics there and kind of lay it out, more of the similar vein. And a fella stood up at the end of the question and answer time, and he said, I wasn't sure what you were going to say, but I wanted to come in here because I heard you were talking about this prosperity gospel, and, I go to one of these churches. And it was interesting. He said, what you're saying is what I want, too. I don't want to just get rich. I want to be part of a economy, of a family where everybody has enough. And He says, you know, I'm coming from a place where I know a lot of people who haven't had enough, and I want to see that, and I want to see that in the church. You know, he said that's what kind of drew him to that church. I was glad. I was glad he came, and I was glad to hear that. I do think, though, that the way that certain people have set themselves up as icons of success in Jesus' name and have used their church's, you know, nonprofit status to give a Bentley to another prosperity preacher so that preacher's organization could give a Bentley to her. I think there's something deeply wicked about that. I think it's deeply wicked because there are poor people in these churches, right? There are people who have deep need. It's not that they're not considering those poor people over in Africa. They have poor people in their pews, and they're exploiting them for the sake of building up their own empire. And that's about as far from Jesus as I can imagine. So I want to name the wickedness without demonizing anybody within these things, because I don't think that it's any individual's issue. I think it's actually a power. I think money is a power that tries to claim all of our lives, and that only the power of God can overcome it. I don't think any person has the strength to overcome it on their own.
I'd like to ask you a question about the prodigal son. Most, but not all, of the sermons I've heard on the topic have as their central core, well, this young man goes off and he wastes all his money, he lives in sin, and then he realizes how stupid that is, he comes back and his father accepts him and everything's wonderful. Yeah. But most preachers seem to miss what I think is the punchline of the story, and that is the prodigal's brother, who says, what the hell? I've been busting my buns here for the young man, and I don't even get so much as a kid to have a party with my friends. And we're the prodigal's brother, I think. Hmm. Is that one of those cracks that you're talking about, that we got to see ourselves maybe in a different light?
Yeah, it's a good reading. So, you know, Jesus in the Gospels, he has his hardest time with the Pharisees in terms of the religious leaders of the time. The problem he has with the Pharisees is just this. They think they've got it right. They are the older brother. Well, I don't know if I know enough to say who we are, but I think a lot of us, I think I certainly have been the older brother at times. Christendom did this to us in a lot of ways. You know, a lot of Christianity for over a millennium was really conditioned by the assumption that we were in charge of things and needed to do it well, and that indeed our faith made us better at running things than other people. I think that made it really hard to acknowledge our poverty, our real, real neediness. And it seems to me that this sort of hang-up is there for us sort of on any side of the political spectrum, whether you're conservative or liberal. Because, after all, I mean, you can be just as paternalistic if you think you need to help the poor people as if you think, you know, all those poor people need to help themselves. You know, I think it can happen on either side. So it seems to me Jesus's invitation to this radically different way of dependence on God and on God's economy is a challenge to all of us, wherever we find ourselves politically.
Earlier today, some of us heard you make some pretty provocative and, I thought, very compelling comments about investing. And I wondered if you could restate them this evening, and if there was anything more you would add about that.
So one of the tactics from Jesus is what I call his tactic of eternal investments. Eternal investments, right? He says, store up for yourselves treasure in heaven, because if you store up treasure on earth, you know, moths can eat it and rust can destroy it. But treasure in heaven, that lasts forever, right? I think we really misread that if we do it with the kind of pie in the sky thing where heaven is someplace way out there, because Jesus taught us to pray, what, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So Jesus is all about the kingdom of heaven coming right here on earth. And so whatever it means to invest in heaven, in eternal things, can't mean just sort of betting on Jesus versus anything else when you die. So, you know, how do we take this seriously in terms of eternal investments here on earth? We were talking earlier about the context of churches. I mean, just regular old churches, like, you know, we all go to, those of us who go to church. It seems to me one of the big deals with money is that we don't talk about it at church. You know, I mean, the preacher might talk about how you should give to the church, but we don't actually talk about our money and what we do with it and, you know, what kind of power it has over our lives. But as a matter of fact, when we sit down and talk about it, I mean, I think in almost any church, there are disparities that don't make any sense just on a real like straightforward, logical way. Like if, for example, you have somebody who has, you know, a considerable amount of savings invested in a mutual fund, and at best these days, maybe it's earning about 5 or 6%, and you got somebody else who's paying debt on a credit card at 18, 20, 23, 24%, that just doesn't make any sense. If you actually sat down and talked about it, right? I mean, you know, you're paying this back at this rate, and I'm getting this back. If I just took the money I had invested and paid off your debt, you could pay me back at double what you're paying, you know, and still save money, and I'd make extra money. So it just seems to me that if we sat down and talked about these things in church, we might find some ways to do this economic friendship thing I was talking about earlier amongst each other. Of course, the objection to this is that it's messy, right? You know, the credit card companies can call the law and send them out to get you if you don't pay them. But what am I going to do, you know, if I get in with somebody at my church that has debt and you know, it could get awkward and, you know, might not be fun to sit beside them in church anymore. But, you know, I mean, I completely agree that this can get messy, but it seems to me that that messiness is what we're invited into, you know, and if we're not willing to trust that messiness more than the messiness of the banking and investment system that we have in this world, then we know where our allegiance lies, right? We just trust the banks more. And, you know, these days, the banks can crash just as well as your friend who has debt. So maybe we shouldn't trust them that much.
Our present recession has been compared to the Great Depression a lot. Yeah. And I've heard from a number of people that went through the Depression how precious human relationship, and though they had nothing, those are the good times they remember. I don't know if you can comment just down in the States, because it's definitely impacted you guys down there more than up here. Mm-hmm. If you've witnessed some of that, as far as people, you know, pulling together and finding something other than, you know, the banking system.
It's a good point. I've been quite inspired by just this historical connection, because one of the community movements that really has inspired our community is the Catholic Worker Movement, started by Peter Morin and Dorothy Day. And it was started in the mid-1930s, in the middle of the Great Depression. This kind of movement toward community and towards shared life within the Catholic Church that then spread through much of American Christianity and had an impact far disproportionate to its size came out of just that, just out of sort of seeing the opportunity to proclaim the good news of God's economy in the midst of a depression. So, is that happening now in the States? I mean, I certainly think it is. I see it where I go. But these are my friends, and I go around talking about this stuff. So you know, I don't know if I'm a good commentator on state of the U.S. But for anybody who's potentially sympathetic, what I say is, this is our time. You know, I mean, this is the time to really show. You know, one encouraging thing, the Mennonite Church in the U.S. has been really encouraging to me, because in this whole healthcare crisis that's accompanied followed the economic crisis, what they said was, we really think we need some kind of universal healthcare, but we ought to figure out how we can do it first. And so they started a real intentional effort among the Mennonite churches in the U.S. to make sure that all their, first they realized they had some pastors who weren't insured, so to develop an insurance plan that could cover all their pastors based on contributions from the churches. And they even said, no, you know, radical as this is, they said, big congregations that have more money should have to contribute more. You know, and we're going to actually share with each other in this way. So they've done it, but they've done it with the idea that they want to be good news to the whole country, right? At a time like this, when we're trying to figure out, can we find some way to cover everyone? You know, it might be that if communities and churches inspired by God's economy were able to live out signs of this on a small scale, that somebody might believe that it'd be possible on a larger scale, even if in slightly different ways. So I think there's a... there's what some Christian historians have called a leavening effect of the Christian witness on culture that I believe we forfeit when we just try to kind of get along and survive in whatever culture we find ourselves. And after all, it seems to me that the gospel is only good news for the whole world, which is what Scripture says it is, if the people who try to live their lives according to it imagine themselves to be doing it for the sake of the world, you know, not just for our own sakes. I mean, this has to be about more than Christians taking care of themselves. I do think that how we love one another is extremely important, but only because we've been loved by a God who loves everyone, you know, with the same love.
everything sort of has that same, that same vein of everyone has enough, slowly institutionalizing church into this group where everyone can get help from. It turns sort of into church instead of into a big convenience, or you can find a lot of help there. How do we in our churches sort of stop ourselves from isolating ourselves from society, from taking our mini economy, our God's economy, and isolating it from, the world's economy?
I think Jesus has a tactic that keeps us honest on this. Jesus says, give to whoever asks. I think that's a constant invitation into relationship with people who are beyond, our circle. And in the Christian tradition, that has led to the practice of hospitality in all kinds of communities. Hospitality, not for the sake of sort of giving people a helping hand, but for the sake of remembering who Jesus is, right? I mean, that's the story that Luke tells at the end of his gospel and then echoes again at the end of Acts, is that story of the folks on the road to Emmaus who get interrupted by a stranger who then they invite to dinner, and he turns out to be Jesus. Of course, that's Matthew 25, right? That in doing the works of mercy, whether it's visiting those in prison or welcoming the stranger at your door or, feeding the hungry, you're not doing it to be nice. Not that I'm against being nice, but that's not the point. The point is that that's Jesus, and we worship that guy. And our whole life is about learning to be more like that person. So when the stranger shows up, they're our teacher. They're someone we want to be more like. Because after all, this is what Francis was so great. St. Francis. St. Francis became a beggar to remind us that we're all beggars before a God who's begging us to be part of his family. I mean, that was the whole point, right, of the mendicant movement. And yeah, I think that's an important piece that keeps us from becoming these sort of insular communities that just take care of ourselves. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you could take some of this kind of cooperative and self-help stuff and just turn it into your own little empire on an island that, frankly, can become as corrupt as any bigger system.
A couple times over the course of the last several years, we've done things on international aid and development, and with some eye to the frustrations that people experience. Yeah. So looking beyond your local context in Durham, looking beyond the relational thing, the person that you welcome in, to that global picture, does your community or do you have some sense of this is actually real? We can actually do this. This is a way to exercise God's economy globally.
I think it's especially in face of the economic disparities that we face between the North American context and the rest of the world, I think it's crucial to both recognize and then engage our connections with folks in other places. I just think it's important as Christians for us to say that this wasn't new with globalization, right? We were an international movement long before globalization. And of course, this is the economics of the book of Acts. The church at Jerusalem that shared everything that it had in common and took care of those who were in need a few decades later was in desperate need. And Paul was begging people in Macedonia and in Corinth to give money for a collection he was taking so he could go back and support the church in Jerusalem. So this is not a new thing. When there is disparity in this international body we're part of called the church, we're called to redistribute. But I think what's crucial from the New Testament to now is that we have relationships that make that possible, right? I mean, then it was only possible because Paul was going back and forth between them. Even now, it's only really possible to be a body together and for that to be more than just like the line item in the church budget that makes people feel a little better, that we be in relationship with people. I'm all for the kind of justice movements that are trying to change global financial and political structures to make, the systems that are more just. I'm not against that. I'm all for it. I just think that the church has something even better to offer in the midst of that. We should certainly support those things. But I think in the midst of that, we should be a living example of a body that is connected across these lines. And so our little community that we're part of has relationships with little communities in other places. One of the ones that's most important that I think it's an incredible witness to the church is a group called Word Made Flesh. Is a missions organization, but it's a missions organization that really learned its methodology from Mother Teresa and said that our vocation is to be lovers of Jesus among the poor. And so they're living as communities in the communities of the poorest of the poor in the slums of megacities around the world. And yeah, I think it's important for us as kind of first world people with access to many more resources to be supportive of them and of their friends and their neighborhoods and to be learners from them, right? To be listening to the stories that are coming back, because that connection is just important for the sake of our hearing again the good news and learning our own call to conversion as it is to what resources we can offer to them.
In your experiences of participating in these communities of sharing, how have you seen that dynamic work? And maybe if you could share a little bit about if you've seen that mentality change or what your interaction has been with that.
No, that's a great question, because one of the things that actually experimenting with some kind of shared economics in community, I think one of the things that opens up for us is how our money and our sort of economics of our life is really tied to everything else. So to commit to each other economically is to sort of commit your whole lives together and to everything that entails. And so, for example, I think, you know, when I read in Thessalonians now, where Paul says, whoever doesn't work doesn't eat, I'm convinced they were sharing money. You know, because you have those kind of conversations when you're sharing money. And it's really important that everybody find their way to make their contribution. But that's not the only thing that matters then, because if you're really sharing life together, there's also incentive to make sure that people don't work too much. Because after all, when you're working too much and you're obsessed with your job, you're usually a pretty bad dad. And that means that your family's not doing well, and that affects everybody too, right? So communities that share money have always had to learn to be community in lots of ways, and to be community that really does try to invite every individual to use the gifts that they have to build up everyone else. And that always includes some suffering, you know? I don't want to give the impression that it's not messy. But I think it's the kind of suffering that's redemptive. It's the kind of thing that certainly in the context of a community that prays constantly brings us back to our need for grace and our need to receive God's grace through one another and through the practice of forgiveness. So, yeah, if our money and even our disagreements and our fights about money can bring us back to the main thing and to our ultimate dependence on God, I think that's still good news.
When you talked about money as a power, you mentioned mortgages and how many people in this room probably will have one soon or already have one, and you're locking yourself into a 25, 30-year allegiance to money. How has your community wrestled with this idea? Like, do you guys have a mortgage? How have you paid for your house, really?
Yeah, what I meant to say earlier is that a lot of people feel enslaved in the donkey sort of sense to a system that they may have chosen, but they're not sure why at some points. I mean, I have lots of these kind of conversations with people. I don't mean to say by that community can get you out of all the sort of difficult negotiations with money. But there are experiments to be done for sure. When our community bought a house a few years ago, we called up a lot of our friends and said, we don't have enough cash to just pay for this thing. We don't keep that much laying around, you know. After all, Jesus says, give it away. So we said, if you have any that you could lend to us at no interest, we'd be glad to, you know, to pay it back as we can. Because after all, you know, the scripture does have this sort of suspicion of usury that we've more or less overlooked since the Middle Ages. But, you know, when I was researching this book, it turns out the Muslims have taken it more seriously than we have, we Christians. And I learned a lot from studying Muslim banks. I found this bank called La Riba. In Arabic, La Riba means no interest, because you can't charge interest. And they actually run a bank that that doesn't charge interest. They do have service fees. You know, the people who work there make a living. But the banks aren't making tons of money themselves. And this fascinating thing is, it means then that the banks are actually personally invested in using, you know, the capital that they have wisely. So when this whole housing crisis started, all these banks that had overspeculated were just tanking, especially the, you know how banking is kind of tiered up where banks buy the debt of other banks. And it was the big banks that owned the debt of other banks that were really having a hard time. And it turned out this journalist looked into these Muslim banks, and none of them were suffering because they had sort of invested along with the people who had bought the houses. I think there's something to that. And, you know, we kind of did an experiment with that, and we were able to significantly reduce the mortgage that we took out in order to, you know, buy those gifts that we got from folks that we are paying back without interest. But we weren't able to get it all. So we do have a standard mortgage with Bank of America, it's called. We have it, we hold it together, but we're not ourselves some sort of corporation or entity. So we put two people's name on the mortgage and two other people's name on the deed. And we said, you know, we're all committed to this together. It's, you know, part of our kind of monthly finances. We pool the money that we make and pay our bills and pay our mortgage and, you know, give the rest away.
Thanks for your presentation tonight. I just wonder, have you done any analysis or discussion or prayer around consumption itself? Because when I'm in community with other people, if my brother comes to me and says, will you share with me because I'm hungry, I need food, I feel one way about it. If that same brother comes by and says, I need a Bentley, I somehow feel differently about that.
Yeah.
So I just wonder how you've reflected on this and, you know, whether you're taking this into account as you're developing this concept.
Now, you're absolutely right that one of the big problems of the economy that we're in, it's not just that we're overconsumptive. I mean, we are, that's for sure. But we're becoming more and more so because the economy is structured on a competition system that requires a kind of marketing that creates desires that didn't even exist before, right? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's been written about how now the way they sell things is they don't actually... When the people sit down, smart people, these are the smart people, you know, the folks who were in, who were just the very best in the psych classes in college have gone on to work for these departments. And what they do is they don't think anymore about just how to create a desire for a product, but rather they try to create the desire for desire. Because they found that if you just get people to want something, they'll go buy stuff. And so, you know, I mean, this is huge. I mean, this is kind of the foundation of the economy. And it's closely tied. I mean, this sort of creation of desire upon desire is not just tied to overconsumption, but I think it's intimately tied to the war making of our countries. I mean, we're both involved in these current wars. So yeah, I think that connection is huge, and that learning to live much, much more simply is an important part of community life. I think, though, community is important for it because it's awfully hard to do on your own, you know? It's awfully hard to resist really just these barrage of, you know, of messages saying that, you know, you really should want more. And I think it helps. It actually helps to have other people who you've kind of made promises with and who you're at least having to have conversations with about how you spend your money. Because it's in some ways, it kind of drops the veil on some things. You know, I might really think in my own sort of internal struggle with my desires, I might really think, you know, I could do so much better at my job or something if I just had that iPhone. And, you know, it would help me connect with people. But then, you know, if I actually have to go to some other people and say, I'm thinking I need this iPhone, I don't really want to do that, you know, or whatever it might be. So, yeah, I think community can help us dispel those voices by just having a little accountability of people that we'd have to talk to about it.
I invite you to offer Thanksgiving to Jonathan.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an Ancient Future podcast featuring Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. We have a few other interesting pieces of audio featuring Jonathan, which we will bring forward from the vaults in the coming months. I'm your host, Jamie Howison. Thanks for listening.